Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. We're about to have a conversation with Sherilyn Ifill, who is now the president and director counsel of the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, the Legal Defense Fund as it's known, LDF. Sherilyn Ifill, welcome. Good to have you with us.
It's great to be on, Mark.
Appreciate you taking the time. I know you're very busy.
Thank you.
And let's go back to the Voting Rights Act. And it's interesting that one of the last comments made in this conversation by Bob Summerby was brought up about Mississippi voters having African-American voters in Mississippi having a greater turnout percentage-wise than African-Americans in Massachusetts. So when that's laid out there by the Chief Justice, the story is broader than that. I mean, I like to start there just because it came up at the end.
Well, the point is that it's a red herring. It's, you know, it was quite interesting during the argument when Chief Justice Roberts brought up this disparity. And he advanced it as though it was proof that voting discrimination, you know, is not more prevalent in the South than it is in the North. But, of course, voting discrimination is not made up solely of registration and turnout figures. Registration and turnout is important, of course. It was more important in 1965 when the Voting Rights Act was enacted, and those were the two markers that one could use to make it quite clear what was happening with voting discrimination. But, you know, when Congress reauthorized the Voting Rights Act in 2006, they engaged in hearings over the course of a year, and they found that in the jurisdictions covered by Section 5, most of which happened to be in the South, those areas were replete with voting discrimination of all kinds, polling place changes, one community in Mississippi deciding not to hold an election once the blacks became a majority of the population, annexing white communities in order to maintain white numerical supremacy, de-annexing black communities in order to try and maintain a certain kind of racial balance, redistricting districts to reduce the black population to eliminate black representatives. I mean, that's the range and array of examples of voting discrimination that Congress was looking at when it reauthorized the Voting Rights Act. So simply resorting to describing this disparity in registration and turnout between Massachusetts and Mississippi really doesn't prove anything, frankly. In fact, what it may reflect is simply that black voters in Massachusetts are more satisfied with their representation and maybe feel they have less of an urgent need to get out to the polls. It's not a good thing. Of course, we want people to register. We want people to turn out and have their voice heard. But it's certainly not proof somehow that Massachusetts and Mississippi are at a level of parity when it comes to voting discrimination.
And when the other side made arguments that this has been 40 years, that times have changed, that there are black mayors in Alabama, so it's time to revisit this, and this law was set for the post-civil rights era of 1965, but it has no place in the 21st century.
Well, that's the point, you know, of the hearings that Congress held in 2006, in which, you know, they didn't assume, they inquired what is happening in these jurisdictions that are covered by Section 5. And over the course of 9 months, they amassed this 15,000-page record and heard from 90 witnesses. And the result of that investigation demonstrated the ongoing existence of voting discrimination, not that voting discrimination had been eliminated. And, of course, there's been progress. The progress that's been made has largely been due to the enactment of civil rights statutes for which people, you know, marched and died and sacrificed. That's what produced the change. And we readily admit that there's been progress. We're thrilled that there's been progress. Just because there's been progress doesn't mean the job is done, and the job is not done. And what Shelby County, Alabama, was attempting to argue, and what I fear that some of the Supreme Court justices who spoke, you know, appeared to be suggesting, is that simply because we've made progress, the Voting Rights Act is no longer needed.
So what would happen? What would happen if the majority of the court overturned Section 5? And again, let's explain Section 5 as we do that.
So Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act is in many ways regarded as the most important part of the Voting Rights Act. It requires certain jurisdictions to, if they want to make any voting changes in their jurisdiction, submit those changes to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights, to the Department of Justice, or to a federal district court in Washington, D.C., for what we call preclearance or approval. So if they want to make a polling place change in the jurisdiction, if they want to switch from electing to appointing their judges, if they want to add seats or remove seats from the city council or the town council, they first have to seek preclearance. And the purpose of seeking that preclearance is to determine whether or not the change that's sought would result in discrimination against minority voters. And so it's to protect minority voters, and it's to protect them before the discrimination happens. And what Congress said when they enacted Section 5 is that, you know, we're enacting this to get at what may be future efforts to discriminate against minority voters that we can't even imagine right now, to get at what might be ingenious methods in the future. And Congress did that because it had noted that that's precisely what southern jurisdictions had done. As soon as one form of discrimination was eliminated, they simply shifted to another form of discrimination. So Section 5 was meant quite intentionally, as Congress said, to move the burden from the victims of discrimination to the jurisdictions. Get the plan pre-cleared, and then you can proceed with the plan. But the purpose of pre-clearance is to ensure that there is a look at how the proposed voting change would affect minority voters. So the question you ask is, you know, what happens if there's no Section 5? Well, we don't know, you know, first of all, you know, whether that would happen. It's hard to speculate about that happening. But I think Section 5 has become something that is almost like air. We don't know it's there because it's just working, because it's allowing the Department of Justice and the D.C. District Court to actually take a look. It's compelling jurisdictions to think about how a change they may plan will affect minority voters. It's compelling jurisdictions to interact with the minority community in ways that they might otherwise not have because they know they have to pass Section 5 preclearance. And yet still, there are countless examples of jurisdictions that have attempted to get out from under Section 5 preclearance or have advanced plans that have been found to discriminate. In fact, when Congress was reviewing the Voting Rights Act in 2006, they noted that of the 650 objections to plans that had been proposed by jurisdictions, over 400 of those plans had been objected to because the Justice Department or the D.C. District Court determined that the plans were the result of intentional racial discrimination in voting.
One of the things that when I was looking at, I didn't see the whole transcript, but I read a lot that came out of different journals about what happened on the Supreme Court that day, and you didn't argue, but one of your lead attorneys argued before the court that day.
Yeah.
Was when Justice Scalia talked about a racial entitlement, that this was just really a racial entitlement and perhaps not a constitutional necessity. I mean, what he was saying, and I'd like to talk to this for a minute, the question whether the Constitution should or does afford minorities any real protection for a range of discrimination anymore. I mean, that's what's being called into question here.
Well, let me see if I can kind of break down what Scalia was saying and provide the context. So he made the statement, by the way, when the Solicitor General, the lawyer for the United States government, was arguing, not when the LDF lawyer was arguing.
Okay.
What he said was, and what he was referring to, you read the whole context, he was referring to the fact that the Voting Rights Act, when it was reauthorized in 2006, was reauthorized with an overwhelming bipartisan support, 366 to 33 in the House, 98 to 0 in the Senate.
Right.
So no senator, including the senators from the jurisdictions covered by Section 5, voted against the reauthorization of Section 5 of the Act. And rather than attribute that to the fact that Congress members have come to recognize the importance of the Voting Rights Act and how constituents expect it to be reauthorized, because the Voting Rights Act has been reauthorized four times by Congress and upheld four times, each time it's been challenged by the Supreme Court. So that it's become such a part of the fabric, right, that Congress members, by and large, will not vote against the Voting Rights Act because they recognize its importance in protecting minority voters. It takes the onus off of having to file expensive lawsuits after discrimination happens and instead allows a jurisdiction to go through this administrative preclearance paper process. So rather than accept that too is an evidence of progress, Justice Scalia says, what can be the reason? I mean, why would it be unanimous in the Senate? And he says, it's unanimous because it's the perpetuation of racial entitlement. That's his language.
Right.
And he says, once you have a racial entitlement, it's hard to get rid of it. And then he went on to say something even more extraordinary. That's why we can't trust this to Congress. Which was kind of extraordinary. We should leave it to, you know, it would be great if we could leave it to Congress, but we just can't. Well, so here's the news. The 15th Amendment of the Constitution says that it's Congress's job to determine how to enforce the right to vote free from discrimination. So the 15th Amendment to the Constitution, one of the Civil War amendments, remember 13th, 14th, and 15th,
right.
13th, is the amendment that outlaws slavery. 14th Amendment gives us equal protection and due process under the law. and prohibits states from undermining equal protection and due process. And the 15th Amendment prohibits states and the United States from denying or abridging the right to vote based on race or color. That's the first section. And the second section of the 15th Amendment says Congress has the power to enforce this provision by appropriate legislation. That's what the Voting Rights Act is. It's legislation that Congress enacted to enforce the provisions of the 15th Amendment. And the amendment to the Constitution says Congress has that power. And so long as Congress exercises that power responsibly, it's not really for the Supreme Court to decide that they think differently. It doesn't matter whether I think differently. It doesn't matter, Mark, whether you think differently. The question only is, what did Congress think, and did Congress engage in a process that reasonably provided it with the information that supports the decision that it ultimately made, which in this case is the 15,000-page record, the 90 witnesses, and so forth, that resulted in the reauthorization. So Scalia was just expressing this, like, absolute incredulity that, you know, there could be no senator who voted against reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act. And as I said on Saturday on Melissa Harris-Lacewell's show, it's worth remembering that, you know, Justice Scalia's confirmation vote in the Senate was 98-0. You know, it happens. Sometimes Congress comes together, you know, in a bipartisan fashion, and they make a decision to do something for the what they regard at that time as being in the best interest of the country.
When you said earlier that I mean, and it's true, we don't know what would happen if the Supreme Court overturned Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. But one of the things it would do surely would create these, once again, expensive lawsuits after the fact.
Well, it would create expensive lawsuits after the fact, and there would be a whole series of things for which there would be no lawsuits, or at least no lawsuits that were effective. I mean, take, for example, the decision to move a polling place. By the way, I should note, Section 5 covers mostly southern jurisdictions, nine
right.
states, but also two states that are not in the South, Alaska and Arizona. Protection of language minorities was added to the Voting Rights Act in 1975, and that's how those two jurisdictions are covered. Three boroughs of New York are covered because of the language provisions, and a number of counties in California and so forth, and Texas actually came under in 1975 as a result of that as well. So, you know, when 2 weeks before an election, New York City plans to move a polling place out of Chinatown, as they did in 2000, right, without adequate notice to the community, what, you know, how does the Section 2 lawsuit later, after Election Day, when people discover their polling place is not there, how does that help you? The election still happened. So, you know, the idea that you're going to go and have all these lawsuits, it's great if people are able to fine and finance those lawsuits. But remember, Section 5 was meant to dealt with the things that we wouldn't even think of, the ingenious plans, right? Section 5 was meant to deal with Kill Michael, Mississippi, where in 2006, when it became clear that blacks were about to become the majority of Kill Michael, the city mayor and the town aldermen simply decided not to hold another election so that they could maintain power, so that they could persist in their racial entitlement, shall we say.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the Justice Department that had to use its Section 5 enforcement power to come and say, you have to hold an election. And as a result of that election, the town was able to elect its first black mayor and three black aldermen. So what happens in that circumstance? What happens in the circumstance in the Alaskan villages happened in 2008 when the plan was to move the polling place from the native Alaskan village to a location that would have required the voters to take either a boat or a plane to vote? Well, because of Section 5, the Justice Department said, hey, you know, tell us more about what this plan means. I don't think you can do this, right? And the jurisdiction withdrew the plan to remove that polling place. So it's the protection before the election that's so important. Saying that after the election you can sue, I'm not sure that that's adequate. One, it presumes that one is going to have the resources to sue. Two, it presumes one's going to have the knowledge to sue. Three, it asks us to expend the money and the time. Section 2 lawsuits are costly. They take years to complete. And by that time, the election has already happened. The person who's won the election is already in office, is an incumbent. And even if years later the election is voided, that person has the advantage now of running as an incumbent in an election that should never have happened under the conditions in which it happened.
Well, this is I really appreciate you taking the time and for us today. And I think that we're going to be following this very carefully. We'll see what happens when the decision comes down in June. I think this is one of the most important decisions that will be made. It will affect our country for some time to come. Sherrilyn Ifill is president and director of counsel of the Legal Defense Fund, the NAACP Legal Defense Education Fund.
Mark, it's so important. I'm so glad you had me on. And I would really ask people to go to our website. It's www.naacplds.org. And Mark, maybe you can put a link up to,
we will
to
do
it
that.
On your site. We've got, you know, all of our discussions about Section 5. We have the brief that we filed that includes many of the examples that I just talked about. You know, all of the information that you may want, my account of all of the atmospherics of the oral argument. I did a piece for The Root, and that can be found on our website as well. So please do go to our website at www.naacpldf.org to get more information. And, of course, if you're listening and you want to donate to the Legal Defense Fund,
aha,
you can do that from our site as well.
And, well, should we should as well.
Indeed.
Thank you, Sherilyn, so much.
Thank you, Mark. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. And we're going to take a brief break. We've just finished conversation with Sherilyn Eiffel. I do recommend you going to that website, NAACPLDF.org, and seeing what's going on there. The organization is being transformed into an organization fighting for our civil rights in major ways that it has not done before in a long time. We're going to take a very brief break. When we come back, we are going to talk about the marijuana legislation in Annapolis, and we're also going to have a conversation about different ways we can develop cities rather than the way we do it here in Baltimore and other localities. Don't go away.